Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Carver Watson with Let's Talk.
Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk. Before we start, we acknowledge the sovereignty of all First Nations people right across the country, particularly the local traditional owners of this our local broadcast area here. We also acknowledge our elders, elders of the first people of the land and elders of all more recent arrivals, and of course all of our listeners tuned in right across the National Indigenous Radio Service. It's great to have you with us. Joined in the studio this morning by two special guests, Rob and Emma Kate. Emma, can we just start with a bit of your history, where you're from and where you grew up and all the rest of it?
Yeah, sure. I grew up in Sydney, in the Fibros, as they call it, Lidcombe, inner west, in a very multicultural suburb. Went to school with a lot of Vietnamese refugees, Lebanese refugees, and a lot of racist white people. moved to Brizzy as a young teenager, and went on to uni to do criminology.
No, you poor thing. That's my other degree. I was just talking about I studied. Yeah, I studied criminology.
Awesome.
Yes.
So I did that at QUT and ended up working as a sort of, I guess, a private consultant doing applied research, mainly in community safety and public space safety. So I got to travel the world a lot, particularly in third world areas, as well as, you know, did a lot of university campuses and public spaces around Brisbane, Sydney, Melbourne.
Deadly.
West Australia, yeah.
That's a bit of a shift to what we've come to talk about today, but I'm sure we'll unpack that and about how we found that there. Yeah.
Well, I think the basis of that degree was social justice, you know, so that was a common thread all the way through, and it really drove me later on to make a few different decisions. Mm. Yeah.
Deadly. And Rob?
Yeah, from Western Victoria, Colac, or outside of Colac, just outside of Colac. The Stony Ranges is where my mother's side of the family come from, the Stony Rises, and my dad's family from Camperdown around that area there, but they settled on a dairy farm. So I grew up, born and bred on a dairy farm, fourth generation, and went away. Actually, I got I was being hounded by the Catholics, of, you know, Irish Catholic stock, white fella, and the priests were hunting me down. They really wanted me, the oldest child of nine, you know, you've got to join the priesthood, and they pretty much had me in the, you know, in the job as I was going through year 11, year 12, and then the uncle of mine, he took me on a long drive, and he said, what would you be doing that for? And by the time we come back from Melbourne, we trip to Melbourne picking up stuff, and on the way back he said he just sort of convinced me to get out and see the world a bit, so I joined the Navy the next day. They happened to be in town, the Navy, Army and Air Force, and the local sergeant, I went and saw him, who was my best mate's father, and just said, what do you reckon? And he said, join the Navy, you get multi-skilled, you know, a whole bunch of things, he said, so I joined the Navy and got out of high school and left and become an aircraft engineer. Yeah, so it was pretty...
Bit of travel?
Not a lot, no, because I was a birdie, aircraft engineer, so pretty much... The year I joined, they got rid of the HMAS Sydney, and then the HMAS Melbourne was decommissioned a year later, so we had no aircraft carriers. So I never went to sea. Yeah, never went to sea in my whole 11 years.
Wow.
Apart from in the Sydney Harbour. Did a bit of a diving course off the Sydney Harbour, but I never went out in the actual open ocean. Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, 11 years.
11 years.
Never went to sea. Yeah,
what were our Navy doing?
Yeah, good bloody
waiting.
Good, a lot of money goes into that, and the reason
playing
why
footy.
I left.
Yeah,
I played a lot of footy, a lot of tennis,
a few pub crawls,
quite a few across the country.
Well, it's wonderful to have you both here, I'm sure there are some listeners who probably know of your local business based here in Brisbane, Food Connect. What is Food Connect and how did it come about?
Yeah, well, it came about through I went back home and took over on on the well, share farm with Dad for a couple of years, and in the first year or so, I was pretty geared up to be a, you know, bigger farmer and a better farmer than, you know, one of those, just the competitive, you know, dairy farming spirit, get big or get out, and that was being rammed down our throats.
So you didn't come back planning to be a priest like they planned for you?
No, actually, yeah, that whole...
They were still there waiting?
You still went to church, though.
Yeah, no. For the next 2 years after I joined the Navy, every time I'd come home, Mum would line him up and say, he's coming home. get on to him. And then my brothers would tip me off and I would never come home. Yeah. I'd stay in town.
Yeah.
So it was pretty funny.
The brothers come to you? They come and see you in town?
Yeah, they always come in. And we'd go, you know, go to the pub and catch up with all the old mates. But it was, they were on my tail. Mum was pretty convinced that that was the way. Thank Christ, because this is we're talking the late '70s, early '80s. This is when Mole Cairns was around. You know, so all these big names that we're now seeing. You know, Pell went to school with my mother.
Yeah,
yeah. So absolutely. My uncle probably did me a huge favour. As many years later, that same uncle, my mother's the oldest of 11. Oldest of there was 12. There was 13, so she's... Oh, but
you,
Dad's the youngest
of
nine. Bloody oath, yeah. Born and bred, yeah. I come back and was all geared up to milk more cows than Dad and, you know, and
we had to
milk more cows to pay for me and my wife to be there. I'd come back with my newly wedded wife. And within about 6 months, I'd started to sort of get a bit of an inkling that this get big or get out wasn't quite the go because, you know, there was cows dying and I also noticed that cooperative culture that existed when I was a boy had pretty much disappeared.
So there was a sense of farmers working together and all sort of supporting each other.
There was about 12 co-ops as I was growing up, you know, cream co-op, milk co-op, ice cream co-op, cheese co-op, butter co-op, like all of them were cooperatives and farmers had plenty of choice and there was a lot of camaraderie and a lot of farmers as well. So there was that, you know, there was a real vibrancy, a lot of, you know, footy clubs and tennis clubs, dance, you know, there was just a real, you know, there was just a lot of us
community.
Around. Real community. And when I come back, there was only one cooperative. And so in that 11 years, I got to see. So it was really great to have that perspective as a boy and then coming out and going, geez, what's going on here? It's all changed. It really had. And, you know, the CEO of our company was on $1 million and here we are, you know, on nothing. Trying to make a living, and so the whole thing it was a cooperative, but been demutualised, and then corporatised. You know, with these corporate lot coming in and basically you know doing their corporate thing, and us farmers gradually getting less and less say. So I started to get a bit of an inkling on that side of things, and then just on the farming side of things, and then you know in terms of how we treated our cows, how we treated our animals, how we fed our animals, what we were doing to the land, and. And I was bumping into, you know, these... the chemical companies. There was one particular moment when I went to a field day led by Pivot Fertiliser in co-op with the cooperative, so-called cooperative. And I just read an article a couple of days before that by putting nitrogen on the soil basically froze the microbes. And I went to this... big field day and I had this question in my mind, you know, naive, innocent question. I asked this naively and innocently to the chemical companies, you know, heard this, read this the other day. Anyway, the way I got slapped about by these, and I was really still learning and, you know, green. And just the manner of the reply and the aggressiveness of the reply made me step back a bit and go away and do a bit more research. And then I bumped into these farmers who've been isolated, who have been practicing organic agriculture. So this is the 90s, so 93, 94. And I was bumping into them and they were saying, oh, yeah, you know, read this, read that, you know, all this sort of stuff that had been around for years that wasn't in the mainstream. And, of course, I was in the mainstream. So that maybe changed direction and you know, you go down this fork in the road and you keep going down this fork in the road and you just keep going and it ended up, where I turned the farm over to becoming fully organic, but this is before anyone was...
Sort of knew what organic was.
Yeah, producing organic milk and labelling it organically. So it was a lot of fun, a lot of learning, a lot of, you know, trouble, and my dad was not happy at all. So in the end, I was forced to buy the farm. And for right reasons, you know, Dad said, you know, you want to go down that pathway, you got to buy it off me, you know. So I did. I paid top dollar. The milk prices were at a pretty good high. And I, you know, arrogant white older son said, yeah, no, I'll pay whatever you say, Dad, you know. And he did. He really did put a price on it. And my arrogance, and it was my stupid fault for buying the farm at that price, but that's the thing that's... You know
what that happens when we're trying to prove our parents wrong, doesn't it? Yeah,
like, all the time, every time.
We always come off second best.
Yeah, that's it.
And did I come off second best? So yeah, 4 years later, I'm off the farm. I've lost the whole lot. I'm 3 years of drought and milk prices. I bought the farm in April. June, the opening prices were announced for milk, and it was 20% below what I'd budgeted on, and I was in shitter's ditch. Mm. From that moment on. And the drought just made things worse, and then next year drought. So, you know, three and a half years later, I was out, 90 grand of debt, nothing to my name. The wife had left me. I was an absolute wreck. And in that meantime, as I was talking about that change, a lady approached me on the farm, come up the farm, drove up the driveway one day, and she said, "Can I, you know, camp on your hill for, you know, a night or two?" And yeah, sure, go for your life. And she was a bit. She was like a shaman type person, and I sort of got a bit interested. And she told me, "Oh no, this is secret. This is sacred place. You should contact the local First Nations people and have a yarn to them about this, because this is sacred. This is special." And it was pretty. And you know what? When that shaman come and visited the farm, you know, you get to thinking, because you do a lot of walking around the farm and you notice things, and I always was really pissed off, because whenever a cow had a lame leg or a bit sick, the top of the hill's, you know, a good kilometre and a half from the dairy, instead of walking to the dairy, they would walk to the top of this bloody hill, and then I'd have to, you know, shepherd this lame cow, take an hour, all the way back, and I go, this is just bloody... And then one day it dawned on me, they go up there to get healed. That's why they go there. They go up there... And they feel, you know, that's why these cows wander all the way back
grass
up.
Grass tastes better.
Yeah, right.
Or something. Well, there's an energy in this.
Well, healthier grass might be right. Helping them heal too.
That's it.
Yeah. Yeah, so there was all sorts of things. You know, when you, particularly when you go down this organic pathway and then biodynamic, you really start to observe just other things that go on that aren't visible.
Obvious.
Well, that's what I was just starting to think when you were telling that story. I mean, you must think about food and agriculture differently to a lot of people within the industry.
Oh, hell yeah.
Oh,
yeah. There's a, I mean, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, when we're down the packing line at Food Connect, when we talk to the staff there, they've got to imagine that box that they're curating is, you know, they've got to visualise that some little child's going to open that box and go, you know, it's got to have the wow factor. They've got to pack it like their child is going to unpack that box, and the farmer has to grow that food like it's their child who's going to eat that food. And so that changes, you know, that's a...
Is that the premise of Food Connect?
That's the premise of Food Connect. Yeah. Food Connect is this...
So for people who are completely unfamiliar with Food Connect, what is it? It's not a supermarket.
No.
It's not but essentially it's foodstuffs.
Yeah.
So
it's, for all intents and purposes, it looks like an online supermarket. But it's modelled on the principles of community-supported agriculture, which sort of started...
That sounds like a dense term.
It is, yeah, CSA. So they sort of gained a lot of traction in the 70s in Japan. I think there's 2 million people participating in CSAs in Japan at the moment. North America's huge on it. So it's basically a bunch of... eaters or consumers having a direct relationship with a farmer. They pay an upfront seasonal subscription, and by doing that, they're actually sharing the financial risk of farming with the farmer, so that he can or she can invest in seed and looking after their land and all that sort of stuff up front before the, you know, stuff even grows. And so it just works like that. So we took those principles, or Robert did, with a whole bunch of mums who started Food Connect in 2004, and just thought, let's experiment with this idea, but on a multi-farmer level, because Brisbane, being a much bigger metropolitan area, needed more than just one farmer to supply all the variety that was going to be needed.
And so, not everybody grows everything either.
No, that's
right.
So you've
got to pick your sort of, you know, who you're going to do for particular things.
That's the industrial model, is that you have to specialise in one or two things. You know, you're not, if you branch out more than that, then you're going to lose money. So we really encourage our farmers to experiment with all sorts of different varieties of produce, because in that is biodiversity, which creates its own pest control with different beneficial insects and predators and all that sort of stuff. So you don't need chemicals. And that in turn benefits the soil and water retention. And I don't think any one of our farmers is actually experiencing the current drought in the way that most of Australia is. Because of those growing principles, you know. Mm. So we often talk about regenerative agriculture, and it basically it's a like what Robert was explaining before with his experience on the farm. He transformed from a mechanical mindset to an organic mindset, which basically replicates the kind of mindset of pre-industrial times when people were really embedded in their environment and were inextricably linked, and both spiritually as well as physically. And so that's where the regenerative agriculture movement is heading to. So it's a whole turning their back on the industrialised system, but still trying to operate in this sort of capitalist world that we find ourselves in.
It's almost like he's cutting out the middleman sort of thing. I mean, when you think about where most people now get their food, it's from, like, we don't know.
No, we don't know. Yeah. That's right.
You know, when you go to one of these big supermarkets, sometimes in plastic, anywhere. We literally don't know.
That's
and
right.
then you think about the things that go into that as well. Like if it had to travel on a truck for 2 days to get here. If their sources are only, it's about that mass production. You don't have the diversity and all that sort of
stuff. That's right. The idea around Food Connect is to look at Brisbane and go, well, where should our food come from? Really, you know, so we drew a circle around Brisbane and said, let's be as local as possible. So we don't go beyond 400 Ks. Like, we'll go to Bundaberg for tomatoes in winter if we need to, but that's as far north as we'll go. And far south is Tenafield for garlic, and far west is Millmerran, Chinchilla area. So by doing that, we're actually preserving farmland, because we're returning a fair price back to, because we keep the middle really lean, we're able to return a fair price back to farmers. So they're getting four times what the supermarkets would offer. And that gives them enough capacity to actually care for their land, because a lot of farmers are pushed really to the brink. They're over leveraged with debt. They've been told get big or get out. In order to survive.
To basically feed this huge demand, which is largely owned by supermarkets.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. So supermarkets currently have over 80% of the market share in fresh fruit and veg.
Wow.
So it's a duopoly. You'll often hear that term. But now that Aldi's coming in and IGA are making more of a presence, there's four big players there.
Yeah.
But they're still all doing the same things. They're not doing anything different to improve the system.
Yeah.
And what it does is it creates this mentality of consumers expecting really cheap food, and there's no transparency in the supply chain, and the farmers are the ones that miss out at the end. So the farmers, once the food leaves that farm gate, they've got absolutely no control, because all their food goes to the central markets in Rocklea. So, for example, the banana farmers in North Queensland aren't allowed to sell locally if they've got a contract with the supermarket.
So they actually exclusive contracts and exclusive arrangements to provide to a particular...
That's right. So they've got to send all their bananas down on a semi to Rocklea here in Brisbane, and then they put it back on a different semi, back up to Cairns to get sold in their supermarkets up there.
We send as much butter to New Zealand as New Zealand sends across here. So there's all this, you know, ridiculous waste.
So there's so much...
And it's all about commercial transactions, essentially. It's about who's
and free trade agreements. And
who's entered into what deals with who. And
that's right. Yeah.
I thought, Aunty Mary Graham, I listened to her give a talk last year at the New Economies Conference, and she summed it up best by saying that when you have this... She called it tough love. When you have this direct relationship with the means of production and the person who's consuming it, then you have this, you know, really healthy tension between responsibility and accountability and the landscape benefits, you know, the economy benefits. You get a better product.
Yeah, better relationships.
It's all about having that eyeball to eyeball, you know, hey, you know, not about certification, not about, you know, whatever brand of organic you want to be, but basically about just having a connection between a good farmer and someone who wants to eat good food and be and participate in you know, because they've got all sorts of skills, as Emma was talking about before. Community-supported agriculture concept is based on this idea of let's let the farmer farm really well and we get around him with marketing skills, you know, storytelling skills, accounting skills, all of those things that lets the farmer just do the right. And then we get in return, you know, fantastic food. We you know, it's true cost. They call it true cost accounting rather than this market-based commodified, you know, where food is just completely commodified.
Yeah, so a lot of our farmers, we just have a stable price with them year-round. You don't see any fluctuations in prices at all.
Yeah.
Year in, year out, really.
And we take all the food.
Yeah, it's interesting we don't hear this side of the story when people are talking about the drought now and farmers across the board. Is that it is an issue in terms of the sorts of, or from your perspective, there is an issue with the sorts of business transactions that they're entered into with these supermarkets?
There's a couple of levels to that, but primarily because farmers are forced to take shortcuts and they're forced to do all of this accreditation around food safety and use all, and they're surrounded by the chemical companies. They haven't got a time to go out and read, you know. Not many farmers have the time to go out and actually research how to grow organically or to have a direct market that they can relate to. So these farmers get out of bed and all they're thinking about is how can I make a buck today? And they'll take whatever shortcuts they can without investing. They've got
no
money. And they've got no money to invest.
You've got to hit a certain quota, I'd imagine, you know, month to month or season to season.
That's right.
Whatever
or they
it
lose
is,
the contract. Yeah. And so all these things are written into the contract that makes it really hard for them to invest in hydrating landscape, invest in themselves.
Building their soil.
Building a relationship with, you know, with who was there before, which is really important. You know, you look at Bruce Pascoe's map of, you know, the food that Indigenous people grew before white man come along, it's just extraordinary, you know, the abundance. And that's the other thing they do. They keep up this superficial idea of scarcity when, you know, in actual fact, there's enough food grown on the planet today to feed about 11 billion people. There's only 7.5 billion of us, yet we all think there's not enough food. So farmers are out there growing all this food, 30% is wasted on the farm, another 30% is wasted in the process and then in, you know, so we're only eating about 30% of the food that's actually grown because we have to, you know,
because of this stupid system we've got.
I feel like this is a rabbit hole.
Yeah, we could go for days.
Yeah, I've got so many questions. But I will ask this question. Yeah. Do you believe that there's a correlation between, you know, from a practical sense as a farmer and, you know, yourself with, you know, doing the research and reading in and around sort of this practice of agriculture, do you think there's a correlation between, you know, droughts and environmental factors in terms of the way land is now cultivated and used in terms of agriculture?
Absolutely.
I mean, there's no doubt about it.
Yeah, the evidence is now coming in. The farmers particularly the farmers who have built a relationship with the First Nations people in their area and have gone back to what do we need to do to bring back, you know, and we're not even close to how it was farmed before.
Stop damming and stuff. Mm-hmm.
Well,
stuff.
I mean, the biggest dam is just hydrating your land. If you can get those, and this is mm-hmm.
You don't need dams if you're hydrating your land well.
Yeah, and just the way we do, we grow all this annual food, whereas
potatoes
before you guys, like stuff that you have to plant every year, whereas you know, back before arrived,
the species that are endemic to us to this country grow all year round. You know, well, there's definitely seasons, of course, but you know,
it was perennial. It's perennial.
You don't have to harvest it and re-sow.
It just grew naturally. I mean, there was harvesting. There was cultivating and harvesting yams and a bunch of other amazing agricultural production pursuits. But that was a minority. The most of the way the First Nations people fed themselves was, you know, in the bush, and it was very
well managed. There was a system to it. I don't know if you've read Bill Gamage's Greatest State on Earth.
Yeah.
There was clearly an observable pattern and way of managing
Absolutely.
The country.
Yeah. Yeah.
That didn't require barbed wire fences.
No, but didn't require fences.
Mm.
What is hydrating land when you say that? What's that mean? What's
so
hydrating?
Getting water into the soil.
So that's not just by...
You hydrate.
Rain?
You hydrate the land.
I'm going to say, forgive my ignorance.
You hydrate the land by building your soil, organic matter. So the more you look after your soil, the more you return organic matter into your soil, the greater capacity it has to store the water when it does rain. Mm. So you actually don't need to artificially irrigate through dams or blocking rivers or, you know, pumping out of the river or the creek or whatever. You don't need to do that if you're constantly looking after your soils. Mm. And also increasing, you know, the biodiversity in your water catchment. So if you can, you know, get in with your land care and, you know, replant along the creek lines.
Understand what your natural sort of, was the natural ecosystem there and start to recreate that.
Yeah.
And then it'll help filtrate the water and do all those things and regenerate the soils and stuff. I'd imagine like healthy soil means healthier food too, like, it sounds fairly rudimentary.
The nutrient density in food that's grown in organically, like organic soil with a high...
not certified, but just...
Yeah, just spray-free, you know, natural farming methods. You know, it's... it's fresher, especially if we're dealing with a local food system. It's not travelling as long to get to your door. But also, like, you can literally feel the energy jumping out of the lettuce when it comes into the warehouse. You just want to munch on it. And it's sweeter and it's not as bitter and, like, yeah, the taste. If you can taste a Food Connect tomato compared to a supermarket tomato... that's the answer.
I reckon that's a challenge. We could do that on air.
We should have brought some.
Yeah, I reckon you bring some tomatoes in next week. We'll put this theory to the
to
test.
The test.
Now, you spoke there earlier about chemical companies. What are you talking about when you're talking about chemical companies? These like pesticides and things that
all the sides
and dressings.
Pesticides, fungicides, pesticides, mucicides, all of the sides. It's funny how all of them have side, and the only other word is suicide. Like, there's not many words in the English language that actually end in side.
Yeah, homicide.
Yeah, but they're all pretty.
You know, they're all bad. They're all about exterminating something, aren't they?
Yeah, that's it. Genocide.
Yeah, it's not a good one, is it?
No.
Ecocide.
Ecocide.
They're all.
It must be Latin for terminate or something like that, because that's what they're really doing. They're terminating the germs. They're terminating the good germs, the microbes.
Yeah, so some of these are actually good things as well, the things that they...
They're terminating the life. That's what they're doing.
So even the things that now, when we say you should go and eat tomatoes or cucumbers or lettuce, or all those salad things and the green things that we tell our kids to eat... Are we actually eating sort of less nutritious versions of those?
Absolutely.
I mean, as soon as you harvest, you know, a piece of fruit or, you know, lettuce or whatever, it immediately starts losing its energy and its water content and its nutrient density. So the sooner you can eat it, the more nutrients you're going to get. So for every day that you're delaying that, and, you know, often we'll see apples stored for years before they get to the supermarket shelves. It's a common practice for supermarkets to, in their cold chain storage, to you know, keep things in specially gassed rooms to keep them at a certain temperature so they don't ripen until they hit the supermarket shelves.
You always see them tomatoes a bit green and stuff in the supermarkets.
Yeah. Yeah. They're pick green. Yeah. So pretty much all, they're always pick green and then they're put in a ripening room and then force ripened.
Yeah.
They don't use like a form of preservatives or anything, do they?
No, not that we know of.
No,
we know that there's definitely
can't prove it.
There's all clever things they use.
With temperature control
genetic
and
modification and gases as well. Gases.
So you find out ones that last longer and breed them ones and
that's
sort of thing.
There's gases they use now that can basically hold the life of a tomato until it's ready to hit market. But the other side of things is we've got a lot of scientific data now that shows the nutrient quality of old heirloom cucumbers, tomatoes, those sort of things compared to now. And there's so many, you know, we've reduced both the nutrient quantity and the variety that used to be around. There used to be, you know, 50 varieties of tomatoes. Now there's, you know, two or three. Same with potato. There's a huge amount of potato varieties now. You know, there's five or six. I mean, when I first started Food Connect, there was just the Sebago and a couple of things. But over the last, you know, there's been a revolution in the last 5 years in particular.
With our farmers.
So we're starting to see people really become really, they're cottoning on that they've been fed a bit of bullshit for a while and they want to sort of get to the real deal.
I guess the best way to describe that nutrient density thing is that, like, One apple 50 years ago has the same nutrient density as four. So you would need to eat four apples compared to one apple.
Yeah, right. 50 and years that's ago the sort of question that I was getting. Yeah. Like in this day and age, we're not getting the same sort of health.
Nah. No. Well, so it's like a quarter of what you used to get. Yeah.
And in your view, scientific sort of theory, is that it's because of these farming practices of not ensuring the nutrient content in the soil is
it's actually
basically killing the soils.
And the science and the industry even admit it. You know, for probably 20 or 30 years, they were growing plants not for their flavour or for the nutrient density; it was for shelf life and to be harvested quickly. So, like a tomato variety that hits the shelf today has to go through plant breeding rights where it can pass the 20-kilometer-hour crash test. So it'd actually be able to withstand you chucking it at a wall at 20 kilometres an hour.
Or a truck crashing on the highway.
You're kidding.
So that's because the speed of the harvesting, the way it comes up into the back of the truck and it drops, it's going at such a speed, and then it has to withstand whatever, you know, 4 or 5, 6 weeks
handling
and moving around. So
what is the average time if you go to a supermarket, the average time of something that somebody will pick up, tomato or an apple or whatever?
It's more... The time varies on how fast, but the 20, they call it, it's a basket test. It's a Queensland thing that's around Australia. 23 items, your weekly 23 items that everyone would generally
on average
travels 71,000 kilometres. So when you think about...
That's not just food though, is it?
No, that is all. That's just the food basket.
Oh, right.
23 things in a food basket. So that's a truck, and so 26,000 of those kilometres is on the road. The rest is air. So it's a massive. So if you think about how long would it take for something, you know, for those 23 things to come 71,000 kilometres, that gives you a bit of a idea of the time frame. Yeah.
Have you done the same for your Food Connect boxes?
Yeah.
What's the time distance?
Our distance is 2,600 for the 23 for the same 23 items.
Yeah. Wow!
So it's a massive, massive reduction. And
So for our listeners out there, if you've just tuned in, we're talking to Rob and Emma Kate from Food Connect, and Food Connect is a online supermarket, but also a community
supported
agriculture.
We actually describe ourselves as a social enterprise because we use business as a tool for good, for creating good. So we exist in a capitalist world, but we want to make sure that we're not causing any damage in the process. So wherever we can, we look at, okay, well, let's... A lot of food businesses and supermarkets externalise a lot of the costs to the environment and to society because of the food system and the way it's structured. So what we've done is we've tried to go, okay, where can we internalise those costs all along the supply chain as well as in our relationships with the suppliers and the customers? So we try and create social and environmental impact through doing business for good. It's a different way of doing business. It's not as profitable, obviously, because we're taking on a lot of the costs of...
Yeah, but what do people mean by profitable? You know, is it going to help you to sleep better if you got, you know, a fat bank account?
Well, we're still here after 13 years, so that in itself is, you know...
No, that's right. I mean, most people... leave their values at home and go to work and do whatever they do. But we just want
to walk the talk. That's the important thing.
And you're actually engaging with a clientele and people who want to be part of something that is they feel good about.
Yeah, deeply varied in the concept is this idea or notion of we want to remove that idea of being passive consumers into active eaters.
I think that's something we forget.
Food citizens. Mm.
Yeah, I think that's something we forget all the time in terms of we are all consumers.
Yeah.
We all pay our hard-earned money and dollars to services and products, but sometimes we don't always know the history of or the ethics of.
Mm. Yep.
And it really is, I guess. It really does pay. And I think it is sort of growing. There's a growing awareness of people wanting to support organisations and companies that are conducted in an ethical way, or in a way that agrees with their ethics.
Particularly in the millennials. Like, they're really demanding transparency and they're demanding ethics, and it's not much you can get away with.
No, they see right through
Yeah, they see through the bullshit.
And, you know, the social sort of, the social licence that we now... is now being exposed with the banks and and the finance companies and whoever else.
And the
churches.
Consumerism, I guess, is a term for it. And it is growing. People are, you know, as we've seen with the Royal Commission into Banking and the Royal Commission into, you know, child abuse in institutions, all these, you know, the trust in institutions is
waning
rapidly. So, you know, and that's reflected back onto business as well. So
a lot of big corporates now have social responsibility sort of
charters. They do. Some of it's lip service, but we could go deeper with that. But
another rabbit hole, that one.
Yeah,
another rabbit hole, yep.
But, yeah, so what we try and do is just shine a light on a really dark place in the food system and let the consumer educate themselves about it, you know.
Now, how many boxes are you, how many households are you delivering to week to week?
It's hard to tell because over the years we've set up all these buyers clubs because we've had a bit of a demand to, for the, because part of our mission is good food affordably.
So you'll have groups of people who will come together and they'll say, well, they'll negotiate you with a rate.
Yeah, they put a wholesale order in.
Yeah, we've got a whole
so there's, you know, a whole bunch of those.
The whole division of the business now is dedicated towards bulk buying clubs or co-ops. So we roughly estimate over a month, you know, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000. We don't actually know. It's quite broad because our
April to October is our busiest time. And then everyone seems to disappear for a while.
Christmas, people travel and go off and do things.
But the other part of our unique, the retail side of things, is this distribution model where it's dropped off at people's homes. So we don't have any. We've got
no shop front, really.
No, 62 drop-off spots all over Brisbane, and that's, you know,
and a little bit of home delivery.
And some home delivery. And the home delivery's been growing. I reluctantly let home delivery. I really didn't want anyone to get home delivery, to be kept isolated in their home. I feel that I call the City Cousin drop-off points our way of lowering the fences in Brisbane, and because we have seen so many people meet their neighbours for the first time, you know. And this is one of the societal breakdowns. Is this, you know, we're living in these huge cities, and no one really knows each other or trusts each other, and these sort of things. So that was this whole idea of Food Connect was, how can we provide a touch point where some of these, you know, things that have happened over time to society can be broken down, and people can take responsibility and do something about it in their own way.
Mm.
Joined in the studio by Rob and Emma Kate from Food Connect, and we've been talking about so many things: the environment, food, soil, nutrient density, and community-supported agriculture. And it's been wonderful. you guys must have a fair few different hats that you sort of, fair different reading lists that you've gone through, and in sort of, you know, developing Food Connect, and I guess, you know, the sort of the principles and the values of the organisation.
Over the years of, when I, that uncle, that same uncle who, after I lost the farm, he saw I was in a pretty bad way, and he said, why don't you piss off to Tasmania, you know, just get away from this, all the, you know, because I coach footy.
He sounds like a Murray uncle, this uncle.
All our uncles
always giving us good advice.
Uncle Noel, if he's out there, Uncle Noel Coulahan, runs a cleaning contracting business down in Colac. They call him China. China. I don't know why they call him China. I think they call him China because he used to, when he didn't know anyone's name, he'd just call him China. And so he got the nickname China.
There you go.
But anyway, he sent me packing to Tasmania, and my brother, because I owed 90 grand, I had no farm, no nothing, just my old Dodge ute and a couple of things. And my brother gave me a couple of grand and said, why don't you buy some camping gear and when you get to Tassie and just hide for a while, because I had the banks chasing me.
Yeah, right.
It was. Yeah. Yes, that's right. And thankfully, credit cards weren't a big thing in my area, so I didn't have anything there. But I basically bought some camping gear in Devonport and walked all the way to the most northern part of Devonport, up on this bluff, to say goodbye to my farm and, you know, just be as close as I possibly could. And I'm pitching tent, and a brand new tent, brand new camping gear, brand new little Trangie stove, and this Murray fella come up out of the dusk, because it was near on dusk, big fella with a big beard, and, oi, what are you doing here? And I said, oh, just camp, you know, pitching. He said, you can't do that. This is blackfella country, you know. And I went, wow, sorry, mate, I didn't know. And then he said, what are you doing here? And I told him a bit of my story. And anyway, after a bit of a conversation, he figured out I was pretty lost, and told me a few stories about how, because I said, I thought all you mob were gone, you know, like you'd been wiped out, the black line and all that. And he laughed and said, no, we're plenty of us here still, and told me some great stories.
Set you straight?
Set me straight. And he said, you can camp down there. He took me down there and pitched a tent. Anyway, the next morning, I woke up with this bloody, because I was in a really bad way. I'd hit the, you know, I was done all the whole contemplating suicide, too gutless to do it. Just a lot of things had happened in that 3 or 4 months after losing the farm, and even the 6 months up to making that decision. And I woke up that next morning with this bloody, this huge vision or huge epiphany that what I was crying about was just spilt milk compared to what the First Nations people. And it all come to you know, in one clamouring, you know, session in my head was, by God, you know, we'd taken their land, we'd herded them up, we'd shot a heap of them, we'd lied to them, we'd just done all these things for so many years. And that was just, you know, and that was over, whatever, 40, 50, 60,000 years. Here I was crying about the same thing that had happened to me in a much lesser way. I'm only talking 4 generations. I had no connection I did have a pretty good connection compared to other white farmers, but nothing compared to, and that really burned in my soul. And I thought, gee, I've got some work to do here, at both the farming level and at the, how do I bring these two, you know, these two profound insights together into one thing. And so for years I've been reading about Indigenous folklore right around the world, how they do things, how they govern. Because, you know, it's a remarkable feat that up until Cook arrived, you know, you guys govern this country without any lawyers, without any police, without any military. You know, like...
Without guns.
Without, you know, like... And there was, I don't know, 256 countries on the one land, so many other languages, like this.
People often, we all often talk about this, people, I think, mistake it for some sense of sort of utopia or something like that, but certainly there was conflicts and there was
difference
of event. But that thing of, it's amazing what we people and human beings can achieve when we actually remember what is important, you know, and it's not your bank debt, it's not your bank account,
you know,
it's our relationship with people and each other and our relationship with the land, you know, and there is nothing more human than those two things and how rich those things are in our life to really feel human. But we are running short of time now. We've got about 10 minutes to talk about Food Connect Shed.
Oh, yeah, right. That's right.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good segue, and Emma can tell you all about it.
But. So we've been renting that place. We've been in a third of the warehouse. There's been other tenants in the other two-thirds, but we've been there for 12 years, is it? 12? Just over 10.
No, 11 years.
11.
Yeah, 2007.
Anyway, it feels like forever. A long time. And we knew that our landlord was sort of getting to retirement age, and Robert sort of, you know, whispered in his ear on quite a number of occasions, and one day we just got him on a good day and he said, yeah, all right, I'll sell you the building. And we said, can we have first option to buy?
He didn't want to, though. He was really happy taking our money.
That's it, yeah. he was quite comfortable. But he's always been a good supporter of ours, interested in the business, interested in what we're doing, never spent a cent on the building itself, but always really loved what we were doing. So he agreed. We signed an option deed with him last year. So basically what that means is from the 1st of August to the 30th of September, we've got 60 days to exercise that option to buy the building. Now, we could have rallied the troops maybe and put together a deposit to go to the bank to buy, get a loan to buy the building. And there were also a couple of other options with some sort of mature investors who were interested in helping us buy the building. But I said to Rob one day, it's just going to be owned by another white old man, you know, like, is that what we're trying to do here? Like, we're not trying to perpetuate the same thing.
Mm.
We really want to create something different. So why don't we ask our community to buy it with us? And fortunately, at that very same time, Anna from Pledge Me, who is an equity crowdfunding platform, shifted her office from New Zealand over to Brisbane, we struck up a relationship, and she's launching the Australian version of her business, which she's been doing for 6 years in New Zealand, on the same night that we're launching next Tuesday night our equity crowdfunding campaign. So what that basically means is it's new legislation that's just been passed in federal parliament, which allows public unlisted companies to openly ask for investment. So we're asking for a minimum of $2 million because Wayne's asking for $1.8 million to buy the building, and all the legal costs and stamp duty and all that takes it up to $2 million. And a maximum raise of $4 million, which will allow us to retrofit the warehouse into like all the environmental sustainability with solar and water catchment and energy efficiency, but also really great spaces so that food entrepreneurs can come and create their own ethical food businesses. And we also want to create a community space there too, where the community, we've put on a number of events over the years by pushing away the packing lines and setting up the place for film nights and food hub dinners and all sorts of talks and political action and all that sort of stuff.
He's had Bruce Pascoe come and talk about Dark EMU.
Yeah, we've had Bruce Pascoe. We've got Charlie Massey coming soon to talk about his new book, The Cry of the Reed Warbler, which is all about regenerative agriculture. So we're at heart, we're food activists, and we really want to transform the system. And the way we think we can do that is the public owning the means of production. You know, we need to seize back. We need to use capitalist. I was thinking this morning, we need to use the tools of capitalism to piss off the patriarchy.
You need to be like the McDonald's of good.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely. Yeah. Who cares? I mean, I don't, like, whatever works, right, to transform the food system to one that's fair and equitable. And the minimum investment is $500, which we hope is really accessible for marginalised groups to buy in.
So, with people out there who aren't familiar with the term of equity investment,
yep,
it means you actually become a shareholder in a company.
So it's not like a Pledge Me sort of thing, like where Pledge Me is the
it's name not like possible.
Person. It's not like crowdfunding where you just support somebody's good idea
and you get a T-shirt.
Yeah, so people who actually put money towards this,
they become a shareholder in the property.
Yep.
So what will happen down the track, probably not straight away because it's a new company that we've set up, and they'll put we'll get investment to buy the building and retrofit it, and so that will take time to return, to create returns. But essentially, eventually, the way the business model works is you get rental income. It's really basic. You become a property investor, essentially. So you're buying a small stake in the property, and down the track you'll get dividends in the form of rental returns. And you can get in there for as little as $500. So we're really appealing
to... Do you have a sort of a limit to the number of shareholders?
Yeah, legally.
No, there's no limit to the number of shareholders, but the maximum for the public, the maximum amount is $10,000 investment.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yep. And up to $4 million total.
Yes. Yeah, the maximum raise is $4 million. So there's 4 million shares being put out there for shareholders to come along.
And that's so somebody buys $10,000 worth, they'll get... equivalent of $500 a share?
It's a dollar a share.
Okay, dollar a share.
So if you put in $500, you've got 500 shares.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Cool. In the $4 million, because there's a little bit of a pre-money valuation that we've set up. So we've been doing this renting business. Our landlord's allowed us to rent out space in the other part of the warehouse. So we've sort of had management rights for a while. So we've built up some IP around, managing the space as a multi-tenanted food hub, putting events on and all that sort of stuff. So we've got some IP there that's of value. So the pre-money valuation is up around the 400 grand mark. So that gets added to the 4 million shares. So at the end of the day, if we raise $4 million, the whole company's value will be $4,400,000. And you'll own 500 shares in that or 10,000 shares in that. Yeah.
Yeah, but a minimum pledge of
$500.
$500. Yeah. And we've got a couple of schemes, so people who can't afford the 500, we've got a bit smart to be auctioned that will go towards people who can't afford the 500.
Yeah.
So it's basically a way of, it's this distributed ownership is a way of, because it's a direct, you become a direct shareholder, you're basically becoming a custodian of this new revolution around who owns the assets. Mm. Now, at the moment, particularly here in West End, you know, who owns these assets that everyone else, you know, particularly all the shopkeepers down there, they're at the mercy of the landlords.
Mm.
So this is a, you know, it is a really, it's a,
This stuff is as old as money,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah,
that whole thing around goes way back to medieval times where peasants would live on the wealthy landowners, lords, like landlords. That's where the name landlord come from. He was the land of the lord of the land.
That's
the
right.
Yeah. So we're removing that whole thing. By distributing the ownership, we take away the concept of landlord and then everyone becomes custodians of important infrastructure for community.
And they'll have a say in how the place is designed. We're going to co-design it with the shareholders. We're going to, you know, everyone's going to have a chance to be a participant in the whole development
the
of
whole
the
process.
Site.
Yeah. Mm.
And really importantly too is,
yes,
is gala. So we've been going back to that point I made before when I had that epiphany around the day in Tasmania, waking up at Devonport there, was it was really important for me because Food Connect, I could put in the constitution, I put some really good things in there, a 4-to-1 ratio lock, an asset lock, a couple of things that protected the mission. But in this new company, we've really thought hard about this, about how do we, you know,
How do we build in First Nations
How do we embed
epistemology?
Into this, First Nations. So Emma's been working with Gala.
I've been working with Gala Watson to put in a clause.
Never
in the social Your sister?
Yes, my sister for the listeners, Emma.
She's helped us put in a clause in the social mission part of the constitution of this new company that we, the governance side of things, as much as possible we will always refer to First Nations epistemology in decisions that are getting
Definitely. So sort of like, you know, when you're not sure, you look at, you know, how First Nations people made decisions
and those
principles and that sort of stuff. Deadly. Yeah, you should be right. You should have no hassle. You should have no problem. You might have a problem with saving your money, but...
Well, we're just as bad, don't worry. lots of gatherings, lots of fun.
Yeah, that's right.
That's
you'll have a great time with people and your gatherings and
well, that's what it's
and there'll
all
be
about.
People using the spaces, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So as shareholders, you'll all get a discount on venue hire and using the space and all of that.
We're calling them care holders. We're not calling them. We're getting rid of that.
Cool.
Call them care holders.
That's a good one.
You know, if you care, do you give it?
Do you give a care?
Oh, very good. Now, if people want to know more, where do they go?
Yeah, so they can go to the Food Connect Shed website, which is www.foodconnectshed.com.au. You can sign up your interest just by filling out a little form, and there's some other tabs up there that give you a bit more information about it. And if you want to find out more about Pledge Me and the whole equity crowdfunding stuff, go to their website, pledgeme.com.au. They've just come over from New Zealand, so if you want to look at their New Zealand site, which is pledgeme.co.nz, you'll see the 4 years of history they've got in creating amazing social change over there. They've got a real focus on women and social change.
Now, I came out... Yeah,
and actually they're setting up at the moment with their latest raise, they're setting up a partnership with Māori crowdfunding platform so that they can raise money for Māori businesses.
Yeah. Now, I was out there the other day, Tuesday. You already have some key parts there. It is a bit of a hub now.
Yes.
You have people there that are doing things.
Yeah,
so this isn't, you're sort of... Walking the talk, this isn't sort of a new idea, and you've already got some key people and key
we've got
thinkers and brains and hands on deck.
That's it.
We've got an awesome board, an awesome, actually one of the oldest board, he was the one that steered us in this direction. He sort of said, well, why would you want to have 4 or 5 white men owning the building, you know, what difference is that, you know, and then we went, yeah, good point. We've been there running the food hub for 5 or 6 years. So we've got I've got forecasts and all sorts of things that go back and extrapolate those figures from that there. Because basically we've had 4 tenants leave us because we're not big enough. You know, we haven't got the facilities for them to expand. We haven't got the retail, and we're sick of shifting the packing line out of the way every weekend to have a party. 40th, 50th weddings, you know, so this will be a dedicated...
And it's an important part of what you do is that human element. It's that relationships and having a community and people coming together, you know?
We've got Uncle Des Sandy coming to do Welcome to Country.
Deadly.
On the night, launch night, which is next Tuesday.
Next Tuesday night. Now, is it an open event? People can just come down
Turn
and
up.
Say g'day?
Yep. Yeah, we've got beautiful platters of food. We've got chai. We've got kids' face painting and a local band from here in West End, Karilpa Reach. So it should be a good night.
Awesome.
Yeah. And a good beer company.
Yeah, we've got some beer on tap from a local craft brewery as well. So.
Is there a registration place where people have to go to, or they just turn up on next Tuesday night?
They can just go to the Food Connect Shed Facebook site and tell us they're coming.
They're coming.
That'd be good for catering
attending
purposes.
Yeah.
It'd be good to know.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for inviting us.
This is really exciting.
You've been listening to Let's Talk on 98.9 FM. Join us tomorrow. Same time, same place, same station.
98.9 FM News. Indigenous News. Wangan and Jagalingu representative Adrian Baragaba says the federal court's ruling last week was a disappointing result. The federal court has ruled in favour of Indian mining giant Adani over the Native Title Group seeking to block its Carmichael coal mine in Queensland's Galilee Basin. The Wangan and Jagalingu people have been fighting against the mining company and claim they did not give permission for the $16.5 billion mine to go ahead. In Brisbane last week, Justice John Reeves ruled in favour of Adani and ordered the native title holders to pay the mining company's cost. Mr. Baragaba says their position has always been the same and there has never been any free or informed consent with any agreement with Adani. The Wangan and Jagalingu people are divided over the mine, with Adani making a deal with some of the traditional owners, while others say they never agreed to it. Once native title rights are extinguished on the land, they cannot be regained, which Mr. Baragaba says was not explained at a meeting with Indigenous owners in 2016. Adani has welcomed the court's decision. Mr. Baragaba says they will take the matter to the High Court. Two Wiradjuri men are being officially honoured for their bravery more than 160 years after they saved the lives of 68 people during a flood. Yari and Jackie used large bark canoes when the Murijibar River flooded the New South Wales town of Gundagai in June 1852 by piling stranded townspeople into the canoes and taking them to safety. Another 89 locals died as the town was swamped by 2 metres of water. Yari and Jackie, who later changed their names to James McDonald and John Morley, are among 62 Australians honoured in the latest National Bravery Awards announced by Governor-General Sir Peter Cosgrove. Both Yari and Jackie, who worked day and night to rescue people, were each awarded bravery awards for their actions, with locals last year honouring the pair with a large bronze statue in the town. Sir Peter paid tribute to all the Bravery Awards recipients, describing each of them as a source of courage, support and inspiration. A former teacher at a Catholic Aboriginal mission in rural Western Australia has been found not guilty of molesting a member of the Stolen Generations in the 1960s. Michael Francis Moran went on trial in the District Court of WA, charged with indecently dealing with a child. The complainant came forward after the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse filing a statement with police in 2015. The court heard she was removed from her family, made a ward of the state and taken to the mission at aged 4, where she was initially raised by nuns. She claimed she was molested by Mr. Moran, her first white male teacher, not long after she started working at the school when she was aged 10. But on Friday, he was acquitted of all 7 charges against him and walked free from court. We'll have sport up next.
In 2017, over 400,000 new jobs were created. That's more than 1,100 a day. So if you're a small to medium business owner who's wondering about the next step or has changing business needs, there are government initiatives to help you hire, including financial incentives of up to $10,000 to employ eligible staff. If you're ready to get your business growing, go to jobs.gov.au. Authorised by the Australian Government, Canberra.
Program sponsor.
To sport now with the ABC's Chris Classic.
to rugby league now, and a surprise win by the Bulldogs. Lachlan Lewis has had a 22nd birthday to remember by leading the Bulldogs to a one-point victory over the Warriors at the Sydney Olympic Stadium. Not only did Lewis score his first NRL try, but popped up with less than 2 minutes to go to kick the winning field goal from about 30 metres out and to the side of the uprights. The Bulldogs upset the Warriors 27 points to 26 to move away from the wooden spoon. Lewis has told ABC Grandstand that the win is a reward for how much effort the side is putting in at training.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a present, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, we probably shouldn't have gone through the full 80 minute. We could have sealed it up a little bit earlier, but, you know, we're working class and we're working hard for each other, and I guess those tough wins show a bit of character in the squad.
And that's the latest National Indigenous News.
Hi, it's Dan here. Now, people keep asking me where we found Joshio.
Some things are better left a mystery, Darren.
Well, the truth is, we found him in a Kmart doing this.
The sound of an angel descending from the heavens.
And now we're stuck with him and his annoying, opinionated voice.
Hey, I prefer the term passionately engaged in the community.
You wish.
Want to hear my catchphrase?
No.
Bye, Australia.
Tune in weekdays between 10 to 1 to listen to Joshio for all your latest and hottest country and for your chance to win giveaways and prizes.
Bye, Australia.
I have seen it all in paper dreams. I watch it unfold on the screen, but I never understood. I have heard you speak a million words. Now you're talking to me first. I never thought you would. It's a sight I can't describe. Oh, I must be seeing blind.
Hi, this is Sian Evans. You're listening to Joshio on 98.9 FM for the best country.
I'm heading homeless after a good weekend. feel the warmth on my skin. I'm heading homeless after a good weekend. I have myself as my best friend. Learned to hold my own hand, but I want something real, and I need something real. The breeze blows in my hair. I really
off, then you turn me back on by the weekend. And you won't say the words that I want, but you flirt when you're drinking. I see those bubbles pop up like you're texting, then they disappear. Let's cut through the shit and let's get to what we're doing here. Are we just a backseat trying to get it while we can? Are we names and a tattoo? Just a number on a hand. Are we last caught kissing, or will we be reminiscing with each other for the next 40 years? Are we written in the stars, baby, or are we written in the sand? Yeah, I want you to want me to take you back home to my mama. Put my name on your lips, call me yours, and forget all this drama. Forget it all. Your makeup is next to my toothbrush, but you never put it away on the shelf. I'm asking you, baby, cause I'm tired of asking myself.
I'm tired of asking myself.
Are we just a backseat, trying to get it while we can? Are we names and a tattoo, or just a number on a hand? Are we last caught kissing? Are we dancing in the kitchen, baby? Tell me what it is and what it isn't. Are we written in the stars, baby? Or are we written in the sand? Mm-hmm.
trying to get it while we can. Are we names and a tattoo? Or just a number I should wash right off my hands? Are we last call kissing, or will we be reminiscing with each other for the next 40 years? Are we written in the stars, bitten? Or are we written in the sand? Are we written in the stars, bitten?